Welcome to the Evolved Caveman, where men learn to be successful and happy with your host, Dr. John Schinnerer, as he shares the most impactful ideas and practices for you to get the most from your relationships, your work, and from your life. Now here's Dr. John.
Hey everybody, this is Dr. John back with the latest episode of the Evolved Caveman. And today it is my distinct pleasure to have with me Sir Thomas Zeman. He's not really a sir, I just liked adding that. And Tom is a motivational speaker and spiritual researcher. He delivers engaging, uplifting lectures on relationships, life purpose, meditation, and a topic near and dear to my heart, anger management. Tom has written two other acclaimed books in addition to Creating the Relationship of Your Dreams. He's written The Department of Zenitation, A Layman's Guide to Making Spirituality Work in Real Life, and Taming the Anger Dragon, From Pissed Off to Peaceful. And all of them are available on Amazon.com. And he lives outside of Portland, Oregon. And we've been talking about the fires that have hit both Oregon and California. And Tom, tell us a little bit about your experience, because you got pretty damn close to the fires.
Well, before I do that, Dr. John, it's such a pleasure to be honored. I feel honored to come on your program here. You've had some amazing guests. And with an intro like that, would you just let me go home now? I mean, it's, I need you to ask.
Yeah, you don't want to disappoint. I get that.
No. So in answer to your response, yes, the fires have been tumultuous. They've been terrifying here in Oregon. Just in the last year here, we've had more fires on record than we've had in the last 100 years. It's burned, according to the news, NPR, it said, we burned 1.1 million acres. Now that pales in comparison to what California has. My heart goes out to all those folks and my friends out there. You guys have had 4 million. So yeah. Yes, it was smoke. I'm more of an optimist, where my wife is very realistic and very serious about it. She had got ready the day before because we were already in a level one for a few days. The fires were around us within 8 miles. It was a crazy thing. It was the fire of the century in SAC. You had four different fires, a lot more than that, but four big ones that were encroaching, that were all coming close to us. Now, we live outside, as you said, of Portland. I live very close to Estacada, which was one of the big epicenters where people lost everything. And that was coming close, within 8 miles from our house. So the night before, she says, you got to pack a bag. And I'm going, really? Pack a bag, Z. I said, all right. So I did it. She got all 9 cat carriers to put all of our 10 cats in, right? We're cat herders. We're cat rescuers, long story short. and it had to be about between 11 o'clock. Suddenly our phones started going cattywampus. We went from a level one fire danger to a 3. We're hearing get out. We had people pounding on our doors.
And you said that was within 15 minutes going from level one to level 3.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's like your life passes before your eyes. Remaining calm is the thing, is the salvation. But the crazy thing is that we've got fish. We've got koi outside. We've got several koi ponds. And we have, you know, indoor goldfish, these arandas, these big-headed lionfish. We have no time to think. We just hastily, carefully grab them and just put them in the koi pond, praying for the best, because you're dealing with ammonia, pH, temperature differences. They all lived. The interesting thing is that in this 15 minutes, we have to get 10 elderly, mostly elderly cats out. And once you get one in a container, the rest become supernatural. They gain these powers of strength. The fur is flying. We're running around the house. We're stressed. We're like what else do you take? You know, I mean, we're trying to net cats. We got them in record time. And it's one thing to be able to go to a hotel with one cat, but you're not going to a hotel with 10 cats.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm laughing now. I'm sure, you know, it seems funny in hindsight. I'm sure at the time it's frightening, terrifying.
You know, the difference between comedy and tragedy is comedy.
30 seconds.
Comedy is when you have someone else, right? So when you have friends, meet the kind of friends who will take you on your way in. While you're up on your way down. So friends love you. I mean, having people over at your house for even 3 days is like having fish in the fridge. It starts to stink after a bit. 10 cats, and luckily Michelle's godparents were kind enough, and that's another story of when we opened the garage door, we were in all the cats. We're like going, trying to hold them all in. But the good news of everything is that the fires left our entire neighborhood unscathed. We were more concerned with the looting that was going on in there. We had smoke, but then it was crazy. Then the rain started after the fire. So, you know, it's, we wish we would have had that, but everything is back to normal now. And we are very blessed.
And I'm so glad to hear that you're safe and the house is safe and the cats are safe and the fish are safe. there's a lot of safety there. But it's interesting to me just in the last, I think, 4 years, how the change in fires in California, Oregon, sort of the West Coast, it's changed my whole way of thinking. Yes. I mean, we had a fire during this last round of fires. I think a fire got about 8 miles away from us, and the smoke was so bad you couldn't see much at all. And my fiance was so anxious that she needed to go somewhere else. And I was like, okay, great. Where do you want to go? And we just looked on a map for some place on the Western states without smoke, which was really hard to find. And we ended up going to Balboa Island in Newport Beach.
Love it.
You know, did a working vacation for about 10, 11 days. And it was awesome. But we drove 4 hours south in California without a break in smoke. And so it just changes how you're thinking in terms of where you live.
And whether, you know, whatever side of the scientific aisle you're on, whether you say climate change was caused by man or whatever, it does exist. Yeah. And that has a lot to do with this, the temperatures on the earth, the warming of the ice caps, the amounts that we're losing, has a lot to do with this. And it's more than just forest management and some person saying, well, you can rake the forests out. I just want to cry when I heard that.
I was thinking of a big vacuum.
I'm not even going to go there because this is more, if you want me, my anger dragon to start smoking.
No. Yeah. That's not, we don't want to go in that direction.
Yes. But we do want to talk about what I'm into, how I contacted you was that I was very good friends with Christian Conti. I was blessed enough to meet him years ago, and he was kind enough to write the introduction, the foreword actually in my book. That was my selfish reason for first contacting you. Before I wrote this, I didn't know anger doctors even existed.
Yeah.
In my life.
Well, and I got to tell you a funny story about Christian. For those of you who don't know, Christian is very big in the anger management field, probably one of the top three people out there. And it's interesting because I got called, I don't know how long ago it was, 6 years ago, by a producer who was creating a TV show. And they were like, we want an anger management expert to come in and work with a bunch of coaches. We're going to put all these, you know, kind of softball coaches and basketball coaches, all of whom have anger problems. And we're going to have them live in the same house. And we're going to drop one anger management person in the middle of them. And he's going to fix them all within 3 weeks. And I said, nah, it's good. I'll pass. And Christian was the one that they tapped. And he was far braver than I was because I thought this is a recipe for disaster.
Well, you know, it's interesting. He became the MTV reality doctor. It spurred many, many things for him. But just a quick thing about him, what makes him special is that he goes into penitentiaries and this is a big guy. He looks kind of, you know, he's a huge teddy bear.
Yeah.
He looks kind of scary. I mean, he's big, huge, muscular guy, tatted, inked. And he goes into penitentiaries and he works with hardcore felons. And he believes the ideas that he shares help lower the rates of recidivism. In other words, them going back in.
Yeah.
And he does it in a myriad of ways. And he's my hero, as you are. You do wonderful things by helping people. And you're going to get into it because you're going to lead me here down the primrose path. But the biggest challenge, I think, for people is to, first of all, recognize they have an issue. Anger is a powerful emotion. It makes you feel alive. At least it did for me. And I always start these interviews out by saying, anything I say, I'm not saying I'm right. You're right for me. So if you absolutely vehemently disagree with what I say, good for you, because you know you. And that's the purpose, I'm guessing, of John's program and mine, is we want you, the listeners, to know yourself better. You make more educated choices. So that you are controlled. Anger is not a bad thing in itself. In fact, anger is there to protect you. If we go back to the reptilian mind, let's go back 12,000 years ago when we're still, you know, hiding out in caves, and Smilodon, the saber-toothed tiger, is coming by. That fight or flight that you've discussed eloquently in past podcasts too, you need to be ready to go. Mm-hmm. That anger is just part, it's part of that. They mirror each other. And I like to refer it as the anger dragon. The great Dr. Steve McSwain, when he was kind enough to write a review on the book, he said, Tom, actually that we are fighting many dragons, the ego dragon, the worry dragon, but for our talk right now, the anger dragon. So we know, and based on your writings and your dissertations and your podcast, we know that anger is a terrible master, but makes a great servant. Mm-hmm. Figuring out how to utilize anger. You won't be, Buddha said 2,800 years ago, you aren't punished for your anger. You're punished by it. So how do we get to the point before it goes from 0 to 30? Because that power that I felt from getting pissed off, that 30 seconds of rage and anger could destroy 30-year relationships. I mean, anger cost me a marriage to a beautiful woman, very tolerant, very understanding, and finally just had enough of me, and I had enough of me. It cost me relationships, jobs, and it didn't until I was about 50. I just had to sit down and look at myself and say, you're such an a-hole, Z. I mean,
you can say it on here.
I was an asshole. I mean, without a doubt. And I had to be willing for the first time in my life to look at myself in an unflattering light and not to be okay with it, but to accept it, because that's a starting point. And the starting point for me too is not only to do that to make peace with it, because you're not the same person that you were. You might, my hope is that people, the goodness in people, because you know, we have two dragons, you have the good dragon and the bad dragon in us. It's which one dominates is the one you feed. What do you focus on? Focus on good things, and hopefully, and more good things come your way. To get to the point that you understand your body, and you understand the things that your anger triggers that piss you off, to be able to know that within you and to be able to stop that on the spot, that's critical. That for me, you talk about breathing techniques. You have it in past programs, and your guests have too. The 444 has been a lifesaver for me. It's taking right at that point when you feel I carry it in my jaw. A lot of guys carry anger in the jaw. You're grinding. You can just feel your neck starts to tighten. You start getting red. Your eyes are pupillate. Your pupils are dilated. You can feel that fight or flight coming up. Right there, you have a choice. You have a choice to become the watcher, to know what's going on. So when I do that 444, I'm breathing down into Dantian, down into the lower navel, old martial art technique. On four, we hold for four, and we let it out on four. There's a magical thing that happens with breath. I mean, the wisest swamis, gurus, teachers in history have talked about focusing on the breath, the meditative aspect. It allows you to become the watcher, in my opinion. It allows you to take a breath, like I will do right now, because I'm dominating the conversation with you.
Well, and you know, one of the things about breath that's interesting to me is, and I agree that that square breathing, the 4x4 breathing, it's used by special ops soldiers when they're under fire in order to stay calm. That's what they're taught. I've found, and I think, to your point earlier, I think it's whatever works for you. And I think you can play around with different breathing patterns to find out what activates that parasympathetic nervous system for you, that rest and digest response. I found that what I tell my clients now is focus on the exhale and exhale longer than you inhale. So you might inhale for four, then exhale for six. But just stopping and breathing is one of the best ways to interrupt that anger cycle. The other way, I was talking to Dan Tomasulo, who's an expert on hope, and he was saying that there's a study that shows that just stopping and asking yourself, what am I feeling right now, several times throughout the day is one of the best ways to build emotional management skills. And the crazy thing is, it doesn't matter what your answer is. Just the act of stopping and asking the question calms you down. Now, the other thing I wanted to bring up, as I was thinking as you were talking, so, you know, I've been really big on this man box culture and masculinity, and I really truly feel that anger is the primary signature emotion for the vast majority of us men. You know, there is, neuroscience has shown that we have a primary emotion. So, you know, whether it's anger, sadness, fear, happiness, for most men, I would argue it's anger. And it's partly a result of how we're socialized. So if men are taught, men don't feel, and if we're humiliated for, you know, if we show too much sadness or fear when we're younger, and someone, a peer, usually says, dude, don't be such a pussy, don't be a bitch, don't be a girl. And we go, oh shit, I don't like how that feels. And you jump back into the man box. And then on the other side, if you show too much joy, love, romanticism, excitement, someone will say, dude, don't be so gay, don't be a fag. And for the listeners, I apologize for the insults, the slurs, but that's what we get. And that's what we've gotten for at least 50 years. So you get those insults and you go, ouch, that hurts. That's embarrassing. I don't like it. You jump back in the man box. And so we're left with three emotions that we can publicly display without fear of humiliation. So there's lust, stress, and the big one, anger. And the problem that I see for men with anger is that when we get really angry, one of the most fascinating dynamics about it is that we externalize all blame. So if you and I are getting into a heated argument, nothing becomes my fault in my mind. It's all your fault. If you just stop doing X, I'd be fine. And the problem with that is when we get into a relationship, our primary response to criticism from our spouse is defensiveness, which is anger fueled, which means that we are constantly locked into a state of not growing or resisting growth. So at some point we stop to get better. We stop getting better in relationship. What are your thoughts on that? Because I know you've written a book on anger and relationships.
You said it far more eloquently than I am, Mr. PhD, because I'll be talking in a layman's terms, which I think helps a lot of people. You mm-hmm. speak beautifully.
Just different language, yeah.
Yeah, but you speak, what I like about what you, everything that you said, which I concur with 150%, is that it's, if you take what you just said intellectually and then chew it around, it becomes an emotional part of who you are. There's a wonderful book that addresses this in a little different way. It's one of my favorite books. It helped me finish Taming the Anger Dragon by Michael Singer, and it's called Untethered Soul.
Great book.
You just said one of the key points when you said to ask questions during the day. He talks about who watches the watcher. Mm-hmm. Because we are not our emotions. You might think you are. You might think this is your body. As Eckhart Tolle said, the pain body. It's not who we are. That's my belief. We are here. We have to exist within our man body. And I
the
think
the five-layer meat sack.
Yes, the meat sack, just like they talked about in with Will Smith, Men in Black.
Yep.
So in response to what you said, everything you said is correct. You said it beautifully, and not to belabor the point here, but it's knowing us. It's what works for us at the spot. How can we separate what the issue is from how it's affecting us? And really the question is, asking yourself questions for me, figuring out what my anger triggers were, what pisses me off, and why. Not just the traffic that's out there, that, you know, these angry, insane drivers that you
ever... Although that's one of the biggest ones, traffic.
Well, it depends on what pisses you off. When I'm driving with my wife, I really have to be the watcher and watch what I say. Now, I tell her that when I cuss and go back into my Seaman Zeeman days, you can imagine the grief when they call me to the quarterdeck in the Navy, Seaman Zeeman. But I really have to watch it. But to me, that's a much more healthy way for me to cuss and use profanity. Damn it. I can use more. You're trusting.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
But it allows me to get it out. And she doesn't like it, but it's far better than me having to carry it. Because if you've noticed, you've worked with clients, John, I'm going to guess, we have not had this conversation, that the woman or, you know, the partner will say, well, God, they get so pissed off. And then, boom, they can let it go in some cases. And it's the fact, the explosion, it's that intensity.
It's the lack of control.
Yeah, it brings up a lot of other things, too. I still struggle with anger. It's not sure. bad. It doesn't control me. It's you want to make that dragon your friend. Again, I mentioned earlier that the dragon makes a terrible master but a great servant. The dragon's there to actually help you. And it's like in meditation when you talk about the monkey mind, which has thwarted me for 40 years. The monkey mind, as you know.
Yeah, the drunk monkey.
Yes, that you're trying to focus on something, right? And all of a sudden, all the thoughts from your subconscious are squeaking and squawking like a bunch of monkeys. It's the subconscious, the anger dragon aspect of it, that's there to help you. Those are important things. For me, what works on that and helps me bring down to center is acknowledging it. Thank you, anger dragon. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. I appreciate that. It's something that you need to work on. And if you go on.
Yeah, I do like the idea of anger as a messenger.
Yes.
You know, that all emotions are messengers. And if we can just pause and hear the message. So, you know, you want to be aware of it. You want to label it. Oh, I'm starting to get annoyed. What's going on? And then speak to it. But in the speaking to it, you want to be able to separate the emotion from the action. And I think for so many people out there, they fuse the emotion and the action. So I get pissed, I yell, that's all one thing. Whereas it's like, no, you got angry. And then the action was you yelled at your partner. And those are two separate things. Now they do, I mean, they're, you know, it's about a third of a second between them. So it's pretty fast. But to your point, if we, with greater awareness and practice, we can extend that third of a second to a second, 5 seconds, 10 seconds. And then you've got more time to make a rational decision about how to proceed.
You're exactly right. And people, you know, they put labels on everything because it helps me understand label. And it's the judgment. To come from where your point is to know the difference between discernment and judgment. So when we discern, we can step back, we can point it without assigning any blame or anything to it. It allows us to work on it. My suggestion for me and for people is to not just know what pisses you off. I wrote a list. I've got a whole bunch of funny anger triggers. I had a roommate who was a flatulator. This guy was the man.
Really, which was funny at first.
Yeah, he was not. It was pretty stinking funny at his point. But just one of the things. But you have to go deeper and say, okay, we know what's pissing me off, but why is it pissing me off? In addition, you've got to have the emotional intelligence and to be able to have thick skin to know what's bothering you. We have been, you know, you said it in beautiful, an eloquent way that for more, and I think it's greater than 50 years. I think it's thousands of years. But in Western culture in the United States for our conversation, 50 works fine. Real man doesn't show his feelings. A real man doesn't cry. In my opinion, any feeling that we subvert, that we bury down, is going to seek expression in your life, and it's until we deal with it and come mm-hmm. to terms. It doesn't mean that you have to like it, but to accept it yourself. And the key thing out of our podcast today, we all like to sell books. We want to do so, but I want, and like you too, like you, John, from when I've watched a few of your, I came late to the Elevated, the Evolved Caveman podcast. I wish I would have had this like 20 years ago. My life would have been, you know, immeasurably changed. To be able to not, to, you're not that same person that you were. I want to believe that we do the very best we can within the limits of our awareness at the decision time. And when we're putting these emotions down, they're going to seek expression. And you, and I'm coming to a point that you had, it's like the monkey mind, the ADD is mm-hmm. there. Writing them down for me, figuring out what the triggers were, and then using it in a healthy way. Anger in itself, again, putting labels on it is not a bad thing. It's what mm-hmm. we do with it. You know, having anger towards someone else, as Buddha would say, is like drinking poison and hope they die. Because we're the ones that take it. Anger creates so many physical aspects in the body, and it can actually, it can create sleepless nights, as you know. It can create ulcers. It will have a deleterious effect on the body. Take it from there, doctor.
Yeah, cardio, GI, The list goes on and on and on. One of the things I was thinking about as you're talking, though, is the kind of universal anger triggers and the idea that these anger triggers accumulate. And so one of the reasons I bring up traffic as one of the most prevalent rage triggers, I'm not even going to say anger, is because there's a stacking of anger triggers that can happen when we're driving on the freeway in particular. So, I mean, some of the universal anger triggers are personal safety. So if someone comes at you or threatens your body, that can trigger anger. Your spouse slash partner. If someone threatens your spouse or partner, that can trigger anger. Family. If someone threatens your kids or extended family, that can trigger anger. Boundaries. So we have personal boundaries around us. And if people get too close to us, like up in our grill, up in our face, that can trigger anger. Or if someone comes on your property and gets too close to your house, that can trigger anger. Or if someone cuts you off too close to your car on the freeway, that's a violation of your boundary if they come within a few inches. And the other one is actually getting stopped or slowed, which is interesting because that is kind of the definition of traffic. But if you consider that...
It's me.
Yeah. Well, and I remember I had a client who said he was walking in Italy and the pedestrians on the street he was on were so slow, he was going insane. And that's the getting stopped trigger. But if you can recognize these triggers and kind of laugh at him and go, oh yeah, I'm getting annoyed because people are going too slow for me, then you can kind of diffuse it. But think of driving on the freeway, rush hour, you're in the fast lane, you're going 100 in the fast lane. You're like, I'm going plenty fast. A guy comes up sailing behind you and just rides your rear end, and he's within a few feet of your car, and he's going 120. And now, in the past, my interpretation of that would have been, that asshole, I'm going fast enough, he can wait. And maybe you tap on your brakes, which that can lead to all sorts of problems. But what I do now is, I just get over a lane and I flip the interpretation to, he must need to get to his destination faster than I need to get to mine. Maybe there's someone sick or pregnant in the back seat that I can't see. But you know, if you going back to those anger triggers, if someone comes and cuts off your car within a couple feet of your front bumper and you're in the fast lane and you're going fast and you've got, let's say, your wife in the passenger seat and a child in the back seat, that has just triggered the personal safety trigger, the spouse trigger, the family trigger, and a boundary trigger. So there's four anger triggers in one, and they're cumulative, and they create more intense anger the more of them that get violated. And I think that's why we get so much road rage, is because of this stacking of triggers.
You're exactly right. And all the angers can feed on to the other one, because when they're not dealt with, it's that cumulative effect that you spoke to. It's the stepping stone. It's the compoundedness. So how do we deal? How do we deal in a healthy way? When you're talking to your clients, John, in a healthy way, what do you suggest things that they can do to sublimate it or to deal with it?
Well, I mean, there's a lot to it. In the sense, one of the things is creating more awareness around what anger is and how it works. So you're just aware of it going on in the moment, to your point earlier. I think part of it is breathing techniques, which I would put under the umbrella of relaxation techniques. Because I think that most men that I deal with, and I'm sure women as well, but most men, a lot of them don't even know what it feels like to relax. They confuse relaxed with tired, because that sympathetic nervous system, the stress response, is either always on or really easily triggered. And so we're always in that fight, flight, freeze stage at some level, to some degree, which means we're not truly relaxed. So part of it's teaching people just to relax, to know where you want the body to go back to at times. Part of it's stress management techniques, part of it's reinterpretation or reframing. And I would say that part of it's positive psychology. So I don't think you can just remove anger or turn down the volume on your anger intensity and duration, intensity, duration, and frequency. I think that you have to have something to put in its place, because nature abhors a vacuum. And so I think what you want to put in its place is something like positive thoughts, positive emotions, positive interpretation. So this also gets to core beliefs. You know, a lot of angry people that I've worked with believe, some of their core beliefs are like, all people are assholes, or people can't be trusted, or the world's a dangerous place, or people are out to get me. Those core beliefs influence every interaction you have every day of your life.
Agreed.
And not in a good way.
Unless they're
what good do you think?
Unless they're good core beliefs.
Well, that's what I'm saying. But I mean, those in particular, those core beliefs. And no, so I think part of it's an exploration of what are my core beliefs and how do I change them. And I love that because that's pretty easy, actually. It's just a decision.
And you, everything you said is a beautiful book just waiting to happen. I can see it in your future, my dear friend. So again, I pose the question that to stop at that point when we know before it just escalates, what's going to work for me may not work for your listeners. Mm-hmm. We're encouraging them to know themselves, to figure out and figure out, hey, it's okay to be in touch with my feelings. I think the more I had a conversation the other day, I was on an interview in London with my perfect life, Paul, wonderful guy. And he posed a great question because we're talking about the relationship book at that point. What you got to do, in my opinion, and what we talked about before, is you take care of yourself before you create your dream relationship. I mean, you don't look for your soulmate. You become it. And that's a whole nother hour.
Yeah, that's a great statement.
Yeah, he said this. He said, well, Tom, what do you think about how early is it good to start talking about your kids with relationships? And I thought, what a perfect question. And I said, the earlier the better. I said, how you raise kids to feel and be okay with who they are, it's going to change the world. Mm-hmm. And how you interact with them, and not to be hypocritical, do as I say, not as I do. Mm-hmm. You don't become your father, which I vowed that I wouldn't. And here I was later with my two beautiful daughters. And, repeating the same horrible downward spiral that he did because I didn't have the emotional intelligence, because I didn't want to see what an asshole that I was. Hey, it's your fault. If you didn't act that way, I wouldn't get pissed off, would I? So shut up. Do as I say, not as I have spoken. I mean,
yeah. And that's the externalization of blame. That's exactly what it sounds like. And that's what we do.
I don't think that there's any course being taught in school, even grammar school, to help people really deal with who they are, and it's okay to have feelings, it doesn't make you a pussy if you're going to cry. I saw my father cry for the first. He was of the stoic generation of the 50s and 40s, where be with the guy sitting home drinking cans of beer in his underwear and never he would show anger, he'd show laughter at my expense. His favorite for me was, hey, dildo, or hey, derelict, because I didn't understand, the big words.
What they were, yeah.
The first time I saw him cry was when our house burnt to the ground in 1977. And it was ominous in a sense. It was a really weird thing. I mean, him and my mother didn't sleep in the same room together. For many reasons, they didn't have a romantic, it was more of a relationship of convenience for them. But I saw him at 7 o'clock in the morning out in the backyard, like in a fetal position, crying. It was the weirdest thing, but it also, that memory stuck with me and it made it okay, even though we never had to talk about it again. It made it okay for me to delve deeper and say, hey, it's okay to find that, for guys to be okay with the feminine side. We talk about yin and yang. I like to liken that to the human body, that we have both positive and negative. We have male and female. Guys have estrogen, small amounts in it. Talk to a doctor about that. We have testosterone. Unfortunately, the testosterone that's what's, enraging the anger as well. That's like adding a little gasoline to the fire. So it made it okay for me to discover that, but it didn't happen for many years. Yeah, I'm this guy teaching meditation, the martial art guy that taught classes, but yet I'm coming home and I'm screaming and I'm not, I mean, I could hide it very well. You'd meet me out in public and the most charming guy, I'm a glass salesman, right, for years. I'd come into your office and they go, oh, this is the nicest, most enthusiastic guy. And then you go home and you're just a jerk.
Well, and that's true for all of us, I think, that are our shittiest emotions, our darkest emotions come out at home. Like, I think we all do it well. Yeah, most of us can do a good job of managing our emotions at work. I mean, that's where we put a lot of energy and attention because we know we have to, otherwise we'll be fired and then broke. And then we come home and we're tired and we're stressed and maybe we've had a couple drinks and maybe the kids are annoying us. And that's when all hell breaks loose. That's when we're at our worst. Partly, I think, because we know the family's not going anywhere, but also partly because that's when you're at your most tired.
We can get away with it.
Yeah.
You can get away with it at this point.
And you're more powerful, especially if you're the husband.
The guy hits the physically. Wife, and then he has her believing, he gaslights her into believing that she actually had that coming.
Yeah. Well, you know,
why does she have two black eyes? Well, I tried to tell her twice. Now.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping, I was teaching an anger management class with a wonderful therapist here in Portland. And when we were doing the workbook for it, there was something that just stuck in my craw, and my anger dragon was fuming. And it's, she made a, the woman that she borrowed this course from, who was supposedly an anger specialist, said that occasional physical outbursts are okay. And I said, no, they're not. No, we are omitting that. I said, think about it. You're a therapist.
Yeah.
That's never okay.
Well, there's research that shows, I mean, and this was old school anger management, right? Yell into a pillow, punch a punching bag. You know, those were pound some clay. Sure. All those train muscle memory to do that when you're triggered. And so if you're training your muscle memory, if you're training the neural pathways, you're more likely to do it when you actually lose control.
You're exactly right. So finding, you know, the healthy ways that we can do that. I'm telling you, the world changes just by controlling our anger. It's such
Not just for us. I mean, I like to think of it as a ripple effect, right? So if I get my anger under control, or if I learn to manage it, it affects my partner, it affects our children, it affects everyone that I work with and come into contact with.
Didn't Martin Luther King say that if you wanted, I'm paraphrasing, if you wanted the whole world to be clean, started at your own doorstep.
Yeah,
it's an absolute ripple effect. This small, go on.
Well, and I think of all emotion as this ripple effect, like throwing a pebble into a pond.
Yes.
There's research by Nicholas Christakis, I think he's at Harvard, who looked at initially like smoking behavior and how a smoker will hang out with other smokers, but then it got into obesity and the same kind of dynamic. But then they looked at happiness and how if you're a happy person or if you're happy that day, I think it's 33% of that happiness rubs off on people that you have direct contact with that day. And then it goes another layer and it's 17% that rubs off on a circle of people that you may never know or never come into contact with. So if that's the case, that tells me that I've got a huge obligation to get my emotional profile under control or managed in order to help the world.
You're emotionally intelligent. In fact, you're on genius level of that way.
The question Thanks.
I'm serious, and I'm not stroking you. I'm dead serious. I deal and coach a lot of folks. So I know I see beauty in what you're saying. And the question still, not to belabor this point, but how do you get the message to people who don't even want to hear it? Because really my belief is that the person has to be ready. It's like the drunk who finally has their final drink. It's like the person who has their last hit, their last shot. Of course, there's recidivism. There's going back to it. You know, things can trigger it. It can just be, the world can come down so bad you've got to have that last drink or whatever. But there is a point, and the 12-step program is a wonderful way to help people. It can. Finding your own 12-step program on this. How do we get this message to people who don't think they have a problem? No, you have a problem. You have a problem. It's not my problem at all. How do we get it to them? Because sometimes people get very angry when you even try to address anything with them. Take it away, Doc.
That's the defensiveness, right? I mean, and so I think you're absolutely right. It's a huge question. And to me, I've spent a lot of my professional career kind of trying to get the message out to men. In particular, because I think they're at the top of the food chain in a patriarchal society, that if we can get to more men, we can give many more people permission to calm down and to feel safe and secure. Because to me, that feeling of safety and security is so big that, I mean, I realize a few years ago that, like, when we're parenting, we want to make our kids feel safe and secure. The vast majority of the time, it's not always good. If we're in a relationship, we want to make the person that we're in a relationship with to feel safe and secure. And if we're at work, we want our team to feel safe and secure. And there's studies to back up all those. And it has to do with activating that parasympathetic nervous system, the rest and digest response, which means that the people are relaxed, which means that they can access more positive emotions, they can access more information, they can think outside of the box, they can create, they can innovate, they can come up with new ways to solve problems, versus having people live in fear, which basically shuts you down. It shuts you down from taking in new information, it shuts you down from thinking outside the box, because when we're in that fight, flight, freeze mode, it's not just our actions that are limited to three potential paths. It's also our thinking. And you know, there's too much old school coaching in terms of football and baseball and other sports where, you know, these coaches think that fear is a good motivator. But there's still a lot of that in the business community, and there's still a lot of that in the parenting community. You know, my kids will do what I say because I tell them to. I'm like, yeah, to a point, until they get bigger than you.
And they're going to remember that, and they're probably going to repeat the same mistakes that you did, and they're going to resent you. People may not remember the things that you give them in life. I tried to buy my kids affection with buying their love. Cars, you know, their favorite jeans, clothes, doing lobster dinners every time that my oldest daughter, Caitlin, who's brilliant. I mean, she got her master's from Queens College in Brooklyn, way smarter than her dad, who's never been to college, right? Self-educated, doing these type of things to do that. And I just want to look, and I digress in many ways. The ADD, I don't take Adderall anymore. And it jumps around, so I digress here. But to thinking I can buy what, you know, their affection and love, yeah, they're going to like it. But they're going to remember, people will think remember a lot more, and this goes back to what you said a few seconds ago, moments. People are going to remember how you treated them more than the things you buy them.
Right.
You can be out in town, and you don't know what's going on. And a lot of people are very stoic. They keep their emotions very close and in. They're having heart problems as a result of it. Could it be the worst day? One smile from you could change their day. A suicidal person who feels like they have nothing to live for, and you, not even knowing them, gives them a smile or gives them a space, and just one small act of kindness changes their life. I think one of the best definition of kindness is doing things for people who can never repay you.
Yeah. Can I jump in with a story? Because I remember I was working with this kid, and he was in high school, and he was the kind of kid that would tell teachers to their face, "Fuck you." So he wasn't very popular among the teachers, and he eventually got kicked out of the high school, went to like a continuation high school where he would do the same thing. And I knew this kid for some time, and I loved this kid. I mean, this kid was awesome in the sense that he has a huge heart. But he was completely misunderstood.
Right.
And he kind of bristled at rules and people telling him what to do. So after I worked with him for a little bit, he got a job at a supermarket where he was a bagger. He was bagging groceries. And he, you know, would come in and he would complain about this lady that was the cashier, and she was like 42, and she was like a lifetime grocery store worker. And he was like, she's such a bitch. Like, she's so negative and she's complaining all the time. And, you know, I just see the customers coming through her line, and they're miserable. She's miserable. And I was like, okay, well, you know, let's look at a way to change this. So what are some of your strengths? So we looked at some of his strengths, and one of his strengths was actually social intelligence. And I said, so how would we put that to play at work? And so we kind of kicked that around a little bit. And I said, okay, so I'm going to challenge you. I want to challenge you. I don't give a shit what the cashier is doing. I don't care. She's out of our control. Let her do her own thing. But here's what I want you to do. I want you to commit to making that interaction that you have with every customer that comes through your line the best interaction of their day. And I'm going to leave that up to you as to how to do that. But here's what happens when you do. You're not going to be able to connect with everyone because some people are going to be depressed or angry or late or whatever. That's okay. But you can still probably connect with 60%+ of them. Those people, they will give you a smile. They will be grateful. You will smile at them and you both walk away with an emotional win. And it's a little one, but they're cumulative. And so over days, you start to feel better and better and better. And people want to come through your line and see you because you know you're good for a smile. They know you're good for a smile. And he did. And I wouldn't say he loved his job after that, but he sure didn't hate it as much. And, you know, then he went on to, you know, get in the Navy and did really well there. And now he's a successful adult. But I went through that exercise with him, I was like, wow, you know, that's a really good idea for me too. And so now every time I go meet with any, I guess you would call them essential workers now, but, you know, Starbucks employee, Safeway employee, like anybody, I try to make a point of connecting with them to see if I can get a smile out of them.
Now, you know what? It's like you teach when, based on what I just saw right now, because I don't know, I don't see any interactions with your clients. In fact, I'm getting the pleasure of just getting to meet you and know you right now from just a few interactions we've had. But it sounds like the way you're connecting with your clients the best is by using the Socratic method. Mm-hmm. And you're having them believe, having them choose of how to do it. You're holding the light down the tunnel. You're letting them make the journey, and without discernment and without being pissed off and just addressing what it has, you're not making them bad because they are not the actions. Now, a person's past actions are a good barometer of what can happen. We know this. Some people don't want to change, but if they genuinely do, with a little encouragement, it can change the world. You talk about trying to make people happy. We got this idea last Christmas, and I can show it to you right now, it's outside, we saw on YouTube the joy and jubilation from a UPS driver when someone had left out some cookies outside. I mean, this guy was doing a happy dance. So we did the same thing. We did a Christmas, we wrapped up a box and Bowen, and we said, for all our amazing delivery people, we love you, help yourself. And we had waters out there and we had other Christmas stuff. Well, people loved it. We could see them. We'd stand back just to be the watcher and see, you know, they're looking around and they're smiling. We've continued it. Now we've got a beautiful wicker basket. I keep Crystal Geyser water. There's something for everybody. There's the sweetness, the saltiness, the chocolate. There is something. And I tell these guys when they see me and they're like, you know, robots. They're in their way. I go, hey, help yourself. Please take something. And they're like, they're blown away. I don't know if we are conditioned as society or men not to be able to accept kindness in some ways. And that's not.
Oh, absolutely. Or compliments.
Or compliments. Because I'll say to women I had gone out with, hey, I really like your dress. Oh, what's wrong with it? I like your hair. What is it? It's immediately dumb. You deal with 10 people in a day, John. 9 people compliment you. Hey, man, I love your head. I just love the way you do that. It's great. Might use the special shaver, and then one person says, dude, you look like a billionaire. What's up with that? What do you focus on later? It's the, that one person going, hey, yep. Bonehead. It's like, so it's be able to change what you're doing with this and with your clients is you're changing their reference point. You're framing it. It's the same information. It's how do you take it? How do we take that? How do we observe that anger? I'm still guilty of it. I can be just mad in a wet hand for a couple seconds, but to recognize it and cool it.
I don't think the goal is to get rid of anger completely, right? Because I think we need anger. It serves a purpose.
Of course.
And so I think, you know, unfortunately, I'm still human. And so I still experience all the emotions out there, which at times is frustrating.
Oh,
for you know, I've told my fiance, like, when I get mad, please, for God's sake, don't say anything about me being an anger management expert.
Exactly.
People want to throw that back at you when you're angry, right? And it's like, I'm still human. I still get angry. I'm just better at dealing with it now.
My wife says the same thing to me. Hey, what would you, I got to tell you this little story. I almost blew away this beautiful relationship with my current wife right now. I'm gregarious. I am the master showman. I'm a Sagittarius rising. I'm the game show host, right? And she's the introvert, kind. She deals with animals. She's very cerebral, very, very empathic. And we hit it off. We both volunteered at this animal shelter, and I was doing there for 20 years, right? I'm raising money for
nice doing job. Cultures.
Well, yeah, thank you. She was doing the work. She's digging the baby roots out of there, going in, working on Sundays, and getting dirty, and we're both helping, right? I did it 20 years. She did 10. I never met her. Finally, we hooked up. Someone at the shelter put us together. We were together for about 3 months, and I was at a party where my ex lived two houses down from me. Okay, she's forgiven me. We became great friends, and I was still trying to make up for all these years, which didn't sit well with my wife right now. I'm still bringing her food and stuff. Mm. Finally, she released me and said, "Hey, you know, we're good." Well, anyway, at this party, my oldest daughter comes into town, and I do a thing called Rib Fest, where it's a 3-day prep on these baby back ribs that to die for, and. Mm. We did it and invited all Caitlin's friends and her parents from Lewis and Clark College, where she graduated from. And it was Rib Fest. And Shannon, the ex, had come down. Beautiful woman. Michelle, my current wife, gorgeous woman. And I'm just feeling like, So at one point in the party, I'm in between. I got Shannon on my left, Michelle on my right, and I'm going, I'm just like going, see? The ego.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the look of death that I got from Shannon, like, what are you doing? And Michelle suddenly got a migraine. and I'm going to wrap this up here shortly. I'm walking to my car with her. It's like she goes, I'm going home. You know, not mean and didn't make a scene. She was embarrassed by me. Okay. Mm. And it was to the point where it almost ended our relationship. We walk into the car and it's quiet. And I'm in touch with my feelings. And it's loud. And it's that loud and deafening, hearing nothing.
Uh-huh.
And finally, I said, I'm feeling really, you know, really troubled, really insecure right now. Oh, what's going on? And she just very calmly looked at me. She goes, what would your book say? Mr. Zen Master. That's my first book, The Zenitation, the spiritual guy, right? The Om.
Yeah, how are you doing on ego now, buddy?
Yeah.
It's triggering, right? It's kind of like you get your own stuff thrown in your face. And it's like, okay, let me breathe into that.
I got to throw this last part in. So for us talking like every day, texting for months, and suddenly, this was like on a Thursday, not to hear from her the whole next day. That bitch. And then said, yeah. I wrote her this Dear John letter, right? I talk about the book. And it took me 4 hours to craft. And I said, you know, Michelle, you're the most beautiful woman. Hey, you're kind. And, you know, and I was really thinking we had a future, but I want to wish you the best of luck. And you were great. And good luck to you. 2 hours later, I get this amazing letter. Oh, Tom, I've had the greatest time with you. You're certainly a wonderful man. I hope you find someone. Good luck to you. Bitch! I'm the master. Yeah. What are you doing? So I chewed that around on a Sunday, and then like on Tuesday, I called her. I said, I miss you. And we were married 4 months
later. To me, that's a great story in the sense that it highlights some of the emotions underneath the anger. Oh. Yeah. And I'm always telling clients, like, look, often what's underneath my anger is hurt. Probably 90% of the time, it's like, wait, someone just hurt my feelings, and I'm mad about that. But if you can get to that point, it's a much different conversation if you say to your girlfriend or your spouse or whatever, you know, oh, I can't, you know, I'm so pissed that you did this and this and this and this, you bitch. Like, that angry direction of the conversation is completely and radically different from, hey, you know, my feelings really got hurt when you were making eyes at that guy in the bar. Like, I'm feeling a little bit insecure. That's a totally different conversation. I would argue that leads in a totally different path and is much easier for the other person to hear. And that's, you know, that's vulnerability, right? That's getting to those softer, more vulnerable emotions like sadness, hurt, fear, insecurity, defensiveness. And it's a much better way to go if you can get there.
You just said one of my great favorite teachers in psychology was Dr. David Viscott. I had the pleasure to meet him before he passed away when I was living in LA. In fact, I went to a small room where he was putting on, I had a pager at this point.
That was a while back.
I got to meet him though. And one of the things he said, and I think this is from Language of the Feelings, one of his best-selling books, it says, he talked about reframing the way you do. And this is the first my experience with reframing. And he says, people don't make you mad. And he said this at the class too. He says, it's your reaction to it. And he said, why not change it? Rather than you're pissing me off is when you say that or when you do that, I find myself becoming angry. I find myself becoming hurt because they didn't do it to you. It's that underlying hurt in the layer. So the question is, how do we get to that hurt? How can we do a total truth with ourselves? The thing is, it's like the old Jack Nicholson, you can't handle the truth. Well, really, how deep do you want to go down the rabbit hole, as my great friend Betsy Chassie would say? How deep do you want to go? Are you willing to hear how fucked up you are? Are you willing to deal with it? Can you say, yeah, I am, and I'm going to change? I still get off course, but it's not the level. It's like what you just had eloquently stated. It's not it's not to the explosions that it was. Now, I get pissed off at my keyboard, and I'm going like this because it's freezing up, and I hear Michelle come out. She goes, she asked me one question. Have you meditated today?
Or how much is that helping? I think you're absolutely right. And so I'm aware of time. I got to wrap up. But yes. Tell the people where they can get a hold of you, where they can get a hold of the books for those that want and need more from you.
Hey, this is so kind. And I hope that I want to sell books, obviously, but I hope that there was enough information that was shared today that you can disseminate. You can take one thing from it and it helps. And if you gain from listening to Dr. John here or me, help one person. That's the best thing you can do. So go to my website. I finally stepped into the 21st century. It's Tom. Yeah, I've got a great webmaster. Tom Zieman, TomZieman.com. Look for my books on Amazon. Follow me on Facebook. And I love you. I like you.
Fantastic, Tom. Thank you for a great interview. I think there was a tremendous amount of, I don't know what you want to call them, nuggets or pearls of wisdom there. So I think there's plenty for people to pick up and gnaw on and kind of look at. So thank you very much for sharing. I think it was an outstanding interview.
Couldn't have done it without you. And thanks again for having me. It's very humbled to be here. And you're doing amazing things. So you can. This is your legacy. We should have another program about what will you be remembered for. Don't tell me.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for joining me, Tom. It was fantastic. My pleasure. And that is it for this episode of The Evolved Caveman. Until next time, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Evolved Caveman podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.